Senate Committee on Health and Human Services session this morning, and we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 406.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 406 had a public hearing in February. It allows carriers issuing individual health insurance plans to adjust premium based on tobacco use or non-use. We are back for a work session. Take any action on that.
Yes, entertain a motion. Senate Bill 406.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask some questions?
Yes, sir. I'm
quite confused here. All right. The Dashboard amendments are here. I don't like them. But somebody said, without them, we get into some kind of age discrimination. So I'm just asking a question.
Well, the fact is that they're attempting to make another change in the Senate Bill 406, which would remove the stipulations already in there regarding age. And
was that an issue or not, is what I'm asking.
Well, it wasn't at this committee and with this bill, no. It adds another issue.
I'm just after information here. I'm truly not clear on what happened.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the amendment line 7, it refers to the original bill, which is on page 2, line 10. In that sentence, on line 10 of the original bill, the amendment is asking to delete changes in age and the word tobacco on that line. Its current law says any adjustment attributable to changes in age and differences in benefit design and family composition. By taking out age, that adjustment is removed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm confused because I thought the whole reason for this bill was to address tobacco use.
That's correct.
And so now is it being eliminated from the bill?
That would eliminate not only tobacco, but it would eliminate the age clause that's in there right now. So basically it would change the entire direction of Senate Bill 406.
Who's offering the Dashboard amendment, Mr. Chair?
Jim Gardner.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's your time.
No.
Bring your amendment. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, we put that forward as something to reflect upon. We oppose the bill, but if one.
Who is we?
Mr. Chair, Colt Morris.
Would you introduce
yourself? Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Philip Morris. We oppose the bill, and we would urge a no vote on the bill. But the amendment opposes the issue that if you get into the question of who you bring in and who you bring out in terms of permissible exclusion from community-based rating, why are seniors essentially allowed to be discriminated against? So that's the purpose of the amendment is to pose that issue.
I don't see the equation between tobacco and seniors.
They're both, if this bill were to pass, they're both disfavored classes who can suffer premium discrimination by health insurers. That's the issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Isn't that because you have changes in age and tobacco? Why don't I get rid of the line would read, any adjustment attributable to changes in age. I don't understand. Go ahead.
Just go ahead, Senator.
Well, no, I was just going to say, and my only concern about that was I have a choice on the tobacco. As the eldest member of the group here, I haven't had much choice about the age factor.
My point precisely.
And
that if there is indeed invidious discrimination, it asks one to question whether or not people should be discriminated against in terms of how much they're charged for health insurance on the basis of age, precisely.
But probably, I hate to say that, I'm a worse risk factor than Senator Steele. Well, possibly not with Senator Shields, but
I'm Methodist. That's why.
I'm sorry, Jim. I'm not going to be facetious. I was trying to be gracious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, and so too are people who suffer from disabilities, from chronic conditions, none of whom are permitted to be discriminated against, only the seniors.
I'm going to make this statement because I was here when this situation was messed up. Now, we addressed this issue of discrimination quite thoroughly in the 95 session, and that's at the time that it did not come out. The tobacco was being taken out, and many of us did not know that. And I think it's rather strange that that was made known, and it was agreed upon at the time and accepted that age was a good factor, and that was discussed at length. And so my feeling is that there were certainly reasons, and that was supported, I'm quite certain, if I remember correctly, by yourself with another hat at that particular time, along with your colleagues, because that was a pretty important issue to the insurance companies, as I recall, for several reasons. Number one, this encourages people probably to get insurance ahead of time and get involved in the policy. And we have people that gamble all the time and say, well, I'm young and I shouldn't have a boat or a four-wheeler or take vacations or do this kind of thing rather than buy some health insurance for my family because we want to, maybe we don't need it. And so I think this was kind of an attempt also to make sure that we encourage folks, maybe in a backhanded way, but still encourage them to get insurance and prepare for those things at a younger age rather than wait until they were in a calamity situation and then descend on the insurance company with a little bit of an unreasonable demand at the time when they all of a sudden understood that they couldn't take care of themselves any longer. So I think that was pretty well thrashed out in the 95 session.
Mr. Chair, if I can quickly respond. Our principal concern is with the bill, and we are opposed to the bill because we think that the smoker should be brought into the system so they can get counseling and get the services that everyone else can get. So our principal position is against the bill.
Mr. Chair,
you registered that very well.
If I may help Senator Shields real quickly, for the record, Senator Robert from Pacific Coast requested as well. Senator Shields, in current law, there are four factors that are allowed in individual premium rating. That's benefit design, geography, family makeup, and age. So that's currently in the law.
Right.
And this bill, the way we originally drafted it, would just add tobacco as a fifth characteristic you can look at. And now what they're trying to do is take out our tobacco issue and take out age, knowing that we certainly couldn't support something that didn't include age.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't see age as being in the same category, but my concern about the original bill, and I think I voiced this when we had our original hearing, is that there are all kinds of high-risk behavior, and tobacco use is one of them, and if we're going to start looking at, we're adding tobacco because it is a high-risk behavior in terms of health care, I'm wondering, eventually could we also add, a lot of other high-risk behaviors to this list? That's my concern, is that the original, how the law is now and the things that are on the list now make sense to me. And I know that there were lots of discussions about how you establish what was going to be on that list. And so I'm just concerned that if you start opening up the door, you can start adding all kinds of things, people who have high fat diets or people who don't exercise, or, I mean, you know, there's lots of, well, I don't know if those are silent behaviors, but I just have a concern about us going down that path. And I understand, you know, there's real concern about tobacco use, and it does end up costing us all a lot of money, but,
it's recognized when we passed the tobacco tax, and when we put it on the Oregon Health Plan, that it stands out radically from all of the others. You know, I don't have a problem with the special category for tobacco, given all you got to do is look at what happened in D.C. and the whole suit and the national settlement and, you know, all of that stuff sets tobacco apart, I think, from all the others. But I was just confused by the linkage of tobacco and age. And what we're now, and I'm a little clearer about it, when age has already been in the law, I mean, if I get real simple, the bold print has to do with the tobacco part here, and they link age to it, and I don't quite understand why, because age is already there. I mean, you're opposed to the bill, obviously. You represent Philip Morris. But, you know, why did we link age, which is not in bold and is not a change in the law, with the tobacco in this amendment? You know, that was my question.
Senator, I can easily answer that for you, if the chair allows.
Okay.
Not simply to make it so that the bill is not likable to mostly the requester, but all of the rest of the insurance industry as well.
Well, you know, the thing about it that I see, this tobacco contention was, or clause was in there originally, and it was taken out without, and again, I've got to plead guilty to that. And I think probably Representative Shields and I, neither one, had any idea when we voted to against the discrimination clauses, the stuff that we voted against, had no idea that it was taken out the tobacco issue. And that was not mentioned, that was not brought up, we were never made aware of it, and it's, I'm willing to accept the blame that we did that without very good judgment. But the problem that we have is, don't think there isn't discrimination right now in the insurance industry. Because if you apply for insurance and you're not in a group, and you need a private insurance policy, they don't discriminate against you, they just won't give you the insurance. So you can't get anything. And I'll witness when my daughter was put off of my insurance policy, I thought, well, you know, this is all right, I'm a business person, there's a time when people have to get out on their own. Understand the insurance company can't always cover everybody from cradle to grave and under a family policy. So I asked my agent to give me a policy and application, and we just help her get some private insurance. And my daughter is a large girl, and I guess that would probably go without saying, considering the size of myself. And my wife is fairly good size, and without giving her any kind of a physical or anything else, they just asked for the statistics, and she wrote down, we fill out the application, and they turned it back. She's unequivocally turned down because she's 25 pounds overweight, without giving her a physical, without looking at her, without anything other than just an application. So, if you want to talk about discrimination, I'd have much sooner had size discrimination or a overweight discrimination issue in the clause here and allowed them to say, okay, it's going to cost you $10 a month more until you lose the weight or whatever, until you come down within reason. At least allow her to go ahead and get the insurance and pay the difference. I didn't have a problem with that. I had a real problem with her not being able to get insurance at all. So I'm not sure that maybe we didn't make several mistakes, possibly, in this business of insurance. And again, I don't know that I would disagree with you necessarily that we should. I guess probably some of the health problems that I personally had that have cost my insurance company have been because I wasn't very careful with my diet when I neither smoked or used alcoholic beverages or those kind of things. But I dug myself in a hole to a certain extent with my focus point. So I'm not saying that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be looking at some of these other things too from time to time. and not as a matter so much of discrimination, but just as a matter of fact. If we're going to choose to do certain practices, it's going to cost us unless we make a mental change and are willingness to take care of ourselves. So, but that isn't the particular issue in this particular bill. So, I'm not saying that it couldn't be brought up in another session or so forth, or dealt with in another bill, and have a good discussion and good hearing on it. If you really want to go. But anyway, I'll leave it open to a motion.
Mr. Chair, since you're asking for a motion, I would move Senate Bill 4064 with a new pass.
Senator Shields has moved that we send Senate Bill 406 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objection? First call roll.
Senator Castillo?
Yeah.
Senator Duncan?
Yes.
Senator Shields?
Yes.
Chair Kutcher?
Aye.
The bill is passed. I will carry the bill. Close work session on Senate Bill 406 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1096.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1096 we heard last week, which was revising the mission statement and expanded authority for the Oregon Health District. There is an amendment attached to your staff manager's summary. What the amendment is doing is it's allowing a resident of one health district to receive treatment in an adjoining health district. And it also is requiring that services in one health district, if another health district wants to go into that second district, that they need written permission from that district to bring in additional services or enhance present services or whatever. This was at the request of the sponsors of the bill. Everybody's okay with it. And so we brought it back to the committee for the
action. Sure, I move the dash one amendments.
Okay. I just wanted to mention Senator Duncan approved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1096. We were talked about in line three of the amendment where it says within the boundaries of a health district. We thought that they had left out the word another health district, but we went to legislative council and they say this is the best wording because there could be divisions within districts and stuff like that where this might be a necessary word and this would be more all-inclusive than if you just had another district.
The way it reads now.
Yes. So they wanted to leave the word another out of there and just leave a health district. That's why it came through without a change. Is there further discussion on the amendments? Hearing none to order, is there a motion to accept the bill as amended?
So moved.
Okay, Senator Duncan has moved that we pass Senate Bill 1096 as amended with additional amendments to the Senate floor. That was a due pass.
Due pass, excuse me.
Due pass for recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, we'll first call the roll.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Kutcher?
Aye.
The Senate Bill 1096 as amended with the additional amendments is passed. Senator Duncan?
Sure.
It will be the hearing.
Okay.
Now I'll open a public hearing on SJM-5. We have John Chisholm, American Heart Association, and is it Betty Heaton?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, from the American Heart Association.
Thank you so
much. Welcome this morning, and go ahead and present as you wish. I'm not sure who's first.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, my name is John Chisholm. I'm a staff person with the American Heart Association, and with me this morning is Betty Hooten, one of our volunteers and a stroke survivor. And we're here this morning to speak to you and the other committee members to request support of Senate Memorial, Senate Joint Memorial Number 5. And it's regarding the encouraging our delegation in Washington, D.C., and the President of the United States to please encourage them to maintain the current request for funding for stroke research and, if possible, to increase stroke research. And one of the reasons that we had wanted to have this come from the state of Oregon is that the information that I provided, your administrator talked about the death rate for stroke here in the state of Oregon. For the most recent statistics that are available that compares the death rate for stroke for the United States, the state of Oregon ranks sixth among all the states throughout the country. And we here in Oregon, we here work with the American Heart Association feel that because of that, there should be some attention given to the issue of treatment and prevention of stroke. The President and Congress has the authority to recommend the budget to the National Institutes of Health, and the money that goes to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. And this year, there is a small increase, and we're hoping that there'll be a much larger increase. We feel that the increase in research for stroke will lead to better treatments in terms of individuals who are being rehabilitated after stroke, and also possibly find better ways to detect people who are at high risk for stroke and preventing stroke in the future.
Sure.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chisholm, do we have any idea why Oregon would rank so high in terms of having a number of stroke cases? Are there any, is anyone making any kind of link to what might be leading to that? Or?
Right now, part of it has to do with the aging of the people in the state of Oregon. But when you look at other states that have age groups of individuals who are 65 years or older, it doesn't show here. For example, the state of Arizona and the state of Florida has a very high population of individuals over 65, and they're much lower in terms of the death rate for stroke.
They're higher educated on what to do with their symptoms and warning signs than we possibly are out here. Mm.
Couldn't be anything attributable to the environmental.
I don't think so. Well, smoking again is a large part.
And stroke amongst the wood products industry for all the problems they have.
I wonder if you mentioned Arizona, where you have so many retired people. I wonder if there aren't many, many programs. They're grouped together, they're conscious of it, and they're kind of support kind of groups to tell you what to do and so forth. I kind of think of where my sister goes for, she's a, what do you call them, a snowbird? You know, they go down there and they have all sorts of health kinds of things and everything else going on. So maybe they're getting a better awareness kind of program than we are, because they're all gathered together.
That is a possibility.
Yes,
but for many years, the death rate for stroke within the southeastern states, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska has been fairly high. And here in Oregon, since 1990, when the death rate was at about 62, about 62, well, per 100,000 is about 62.7. It's increased significantly to about 28%.
What is the average in the United States? Maybe it's in here. I'm having trouble with lost. I don't see anything here to say what the rate is. Has the rate in the United States gone up basically overall since 1998, but just not as far?
Yes, it, the rate has gone up since 1990. It hasn't gone up as significantly as it has in the state of Oregon, though.
What is the U.S. average? Do you have those figures?
Per 100,000? I don't have the average for the country. I do have averages showing averages for all the states.
So 600,000 Americans will suffer a stroke in 1999.
That doesn't
count. You're talking about the average
for 100,000.
1990
in Oregon, what would it be average in the U.S.? I mean, would it be 50? What's California? You said the rate in California and the rate in Arizona, you say it's much better than what it is here.
Well, the rate actually ranges, and fortunately I don't have that information with me, but the rates range from the 43 per 100,000 up to about 87 per 100,000.
Where would that 43?
They would be, for example, I gave you examples of Arizona and Florida. Arizona and Florida is on the low end in terms of the death rate and stroke.
That's interesting. They're both warmer states, generally speaking, and they're two elements of race correlation.
They're probably more educated. They have more information out there in some of those states, and people going around and using lectures and those kinds of things.
Yeah. I guess that brings me to a certain extent. I don't mean to...
That's okay.
We need to do something.
I spent some time in Arizona, a very short time in Florida, and I was not impressed that they were any smarter than we were.
Well, I hope,
that was my own statistic.
I hope that I think she meant we're more aware of,
yeah.
More aware awareness of stroke. Yeah. Right. Well, I guess I would certainly hope we do something in this area and keep working hard on the awareness program in Oregon.
Well, one thing I might say is that the Centers for Disease Control has allocated funds for the prevention of stroke. And in the next few years, they may have programs here in the state of Oregon. As I understand it, they're funding some of the states with a higher death rate, those states in the southeastern part of the country first, as pilot states for major prevention programs.
Well, I know, we've had a lot of TV advertisement stuff about high blood pressure and possibility of causing strokes, and a lot of it's been, I think, kind of aimed at the black community, because I understand from some of the advertisements and the things that I heard during those periods of time that there was a tendency to have a little like extended high blood pressure problem or something like that, which makes it a little more prevalent. And I thought some of the advertisements were really well done to grab your attention. And I know I personally thought about it because my grandmother died of stroke and lived in Washington. But this was way prior to me.
With Senator Fisher, that is true. There have been some ads that have been put forth by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute and also the National Institute of Neurological Disorders, but they really have not been given enough money to do a large awareness campaign in the state of Oregon or throughout the United States. And what we're hoping is that increased funding will allow that to happen.
Well, go ahead with your question.
I was just going to say the black and Hispanic population incidence of stroke and rising, and part of it is education.
Would you identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm Betty Hooten from the...
Sorry, I mispronounced your name here. I had trouble reading it.
That's okay.
Jesus.
John, I'm just very appreciative of coming forward earlier and the we've been talking about what's that the next one? They were here before talking about the
What do you call it? Right. And my understanding is we're getting closer. We have them now in the Capitol. We're going to have both the House wings and the Senate wings. And
what we're hoping to do is, as soon as the legislation is, as soon as the bill is passed, then we would be allowed to place them here and also provide training. And we have gotten some commitments to donate two of them to the Capitol. What happens?
I appreciate it, because after that session, I said, wait a minute, why don't we have them in the Capitol? And we started talking to the legislative administrator, and these people started working.
I figured it out.
I know.
We don't need them in the House or the Senate, because all of us legislators are heartless anyway.
From a public hearing session on Senate Joint Memorial. I move with five on that note. And we send it to us for the due pass recommendation. Senator Duncan moves Senate Joint Memorial 5 to the Senate for the due pass recommendation for further discussion. Objection. Hearing none, we'll put call roll. Thank you very much for giving your time and coming here and testifying. And certainly doesn't want to be calls to get folks educated.
Senator Cannon?
Aye.
Senator Still?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Do you have a carrier?
I'll carry it.
Senator Steele will carry it. Senate Joint Memorial 5 without a close of work session on Senate Joint Memorial 5 and open a hearing on public hearing on House Bill 2936. Okay, go ahead. I'll just have you folks end as you wish in whatever order.
I'm Tom Bessonette. I asked for the sponsorship of this bill because of my relationship with the Oregon Alliance iBank, and we're dealing with the area of all types of donations of tissue and organs in the state of Oregon. House Bill 2936 has two, and I, by the way, I will be speaking to the bill itself and the amendments to the bill. Scott McGuire, who's the CEO of the Lion Sight and Hearing Foundation, will speak more about the iBank, and Mary Jane Hunt, who is the director of the Oregon Donor Program, will speak about the rest of the organs. The First Amendment to this bill allows more people to enucleate or remove eyes from the deceased body. Under the current law, only three occupations are allowed to enucleate by statute. One is a physician, the second is a trained technician, and the third is a licensed embalmer. The First Amendment is to allow an apprentice embalmer to enucleate eyes. These people are trained through their schooling to do this, and as a result, they are fully capable. One thing we want to emphasize is that when any organ has been donated and has been removed, or any tissue has been removed, the remains are still viewable if the family would like to have an open casket funeral or anything of this nature, and there is no cost to the donating family. The reason that we would like the apprentice to be able to remove the eyes is because many times the owner, who is the certified enucleator, is not present. They've gone home for the evening or something and death has occurred. The eyes must be removed within 6 hours of death, and so there is a timing that we have to be concerned about. And as a result of this change, we feel that there will be more people that will be able to have the benefit of the donated eyes. We use the eyes for either the cornea transplant or for surgical training or for research. All eyes of any age are usable in the state of Oregon. We have one of the largest research tissue banks in the world here in Oregon because of our line of dye bank. On page two, in 1997, the legislature deleted language, any capable member of the following classes of our individuals, and then they added the majority of the persons within this class. The problem we have there is that we try to get available people to make that decision to donate. You probably have, as I have, on my driver's license, I have a B. On the back of it, it says, upon my death, I want to be an anatomical donor. That is a legal document by statute. However, the doctors and the morticians will not receive or take donated parts without approval of a survivor. And the law now says the majority of the survivors. Well, you can't get them all together at one time, hardly. And as a result, we would like to change it back to what it was prior to 1997. The reason that they will not accept the card, even if it's a signed card as well as this, is that there can be a litigation by other members of the family. Maybe they're unfounded litigation, but the bad publicity of a lawsuit filed against someone for removing the tissue or the eyes or the whatever it might be, brings about a hesitancy for them to proceed. And since this is a volunteer, they will not execute without approval.
Tom, should we maybe not change the law to allow that to be an official document?
Yes, we did that in 1995. But because of the threat of lawsuits, and some in other states, we've had lawsuits filed against people who have removed tissue. I'm going to use that word very liberally, including organs. And although the lawsuit hasn't prevailed, still it's very expensive to defend themselves, as well as the bad publicity that comes out to everybody. And it slows down the donation process.
But cannot a law be designated that does not allow for that? So that this allows that opportunity. I mean, I made the decision. I got to be on my list. I don't wish to have any of my heirs or relatives change my decision on that. I made that decision a long time ago. I would think that I would have a right by doing that and continuing that. There's nobody that says that I can't change my driver's license any time to take that off. Why should we allow the legal profession to come in and snipe away at our wishes? Is that something that we're prohibited in some way by the Constitution of eliminating? Right?
I think that we have a many, many frivolous lawsuits. You've heard that phrase used many times. And that could be one of them that would be declared a frivolous lawsuit. However, I know no way that we could prevent somebody from going to the court and filing a lawsuit against someone that had taken the eyes as an example. And the member said that violates me. I didn't want that to happen. And it is against your wishes, but we also have on page 5 of the law, the current law, an appointment of the person to make that decision. So you could make that appointment, and then they would have the absolute authority to do what you wanted done. And it's already in the statute.
But they would also have the authority to not do it, too, by what you're saying. And they could do that.
Unfortunately, they are going to be the ones to make that decision because you're not going to be here. See, you will be dead.
You know, nobody said that right here before. Because
I understand that. It boggles my mind why we can't. You know, they can stop you from doing all kinds of things through laws without the right of trial or anything else. We mess around here and pass through the Senate yesterday a bill that would exonerate the state if they've made any reasonable attempts at, from any Y2K, basically, any Y2K obligations. Who does the state think it is? Why we didn't go ahead and do the rest of the public that same way, or any other business, if they've made some reasonable attempts to do it, they shouldn't be able to be sued by someone else. But no, we do it for the state. Now, why can't I do that for myself? And that's what I was trying to find out. I don't know, you may not be any more of an attorney than I am, but it seems foolish to me for somebody to be able to come along and reverse my wishes. And I know wills are contested and all this kind of thing, but it would look to me like this thing on my driver's license in a situation where time was of the essence. Who's to say that I'm going to have a accident or something that isn't out of the realm of any of my relatives being contacted for more than 6 hours if that's the deadline on the island. I would guess that some of the other organs are a lot less than 6 hours.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, Mr. McGuire indicated he had some more to put on this.
Yeah.
So, may I?
Chairman Fisher, you feel that an appointment he has to go to, so he's not leaving out of animosity or anything near to that.
Chairman Fisher, you are correct in that you have the right to make the decision. The trouble is the document that records that is often not around at the time of your death. In hospitals today, they send your belongings home or put them in a lockup, and they're not accessible immediately, as accessible as the family and the next of kin. Part of the strategy is to put the B code on the driver's license, to have a donor card in your wallet, and discuss it with your family, since they are the ones able to answer questions when you're no longer able to. And that's the real issue that we're trying to pursue, is to make sure that all three bases are covered. Technically, the law passed in 95 says that the decode on the driver's license is a legal consent. The problem is the procurement agencies, which I represent, the Lions Head Bank of Oregon specifically, have the right to decline if they feel that there is a reason to decline. And at times, the fear of controversy can steer us toward a decline. If there are five family members in the place and four of them are violently objecting and there's a donor card in evidence, our choice is to take the path of least resistance and to say, well, we'll decline in this case since you all are so upset about it. That seldom happens. About 1 in 1,000 cases, there is a dispute among the family members as to the real disposition. Normally, the nurses who are doing the requesting find an indication on a driver's license or a donor card, or the discussion has occurred properly, and they say, oh, yeah, that was his wishes. We're going to honor those. And that's the majority of the situation by a mile. So we've gone a long way toward protecting your rights as an individual to make that decision. Unfortunately, logistics and controversy can tend to get in the way of that.
I'm wondering how I would think that also what probably complicates things is the grieving process. The relatives, the survivors, making decisions maybe they wouldn't otherwise make. If, they just kind of see the situation different as they're going through the grieving process, and having to deal with that part of what happens in this process too, I would imagine. Makes
for
difficult decisions sometimes.
In response to that, Senator Fisher and Senator Costello, we have one person that communicates yearly with each of the hospitals in the state of Oregon, trying to assist these people who will be making that contact with the surviving members, so that the approach asking for donations, which is a requirement now in the state of Oregon, be as sensitive as possible for that grieving condition that does exist, and it certainly is there. That's one of the reasons that we ask everybody to communicate to your loved ones who will be finally making this decision, mm-hmm. that they know what your wills are in this area. Mr. Chairman, I promised your staff it would take us 10 minutes. And so I'm going to move on.
I probably have 10 minutes worth of questions, but it boggles my mind that people can't be free to do something for us an immediate necessity like that. Maybe we'll have to have a D-tattoo somewhere on our body or something.
Mr. Chairman, I would respond to that. I certainly wholeheartedly agree with your concept because there are 1.2 million bees running around in the state of Oregon. And there are approximately 13,000 people who die each year. And as a result of that, donations come about 4.3% of the people who die. So if we could do something else to stimulate, and the best way to do it is to communicate to your loved ones your desires, that we would increase the donations of usable organs substantially.
I know you've been with one. I pulled out mine, and most of my wife has signed it, and then I have. We were together with some friends, and they both signed it. Probably should have had my daughter sign this. I mean, I'm just thinking that might have made it a little bit easier and right down to the crunch.
You got the new.
Chairman Fisher and members of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, I'm Scott McGuire, 2231 Southwest Benford Lake Parkway in Gresham, and I'm here on behalf of the 6,000 members of the Lions Club of Oregon who volunteer their time, efforts, and money-raising abilities in support of the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon. They really have asked me to speak in favor of House Bill 2936. Allowing apprentice embalmers to perform enucleation, which is removal of the whole eye, gives us a new pool of volunteers to help give sight. This should save money for funeral homes who pay their staff members when they perform this function for the Lions Eye Bank, since apprentices are on duty during the evening, nights, and weekends, and the licensed embalmers are not on duty. Part of this need is triggered by the economic changes in the funeral service industry, part by an increase in eye donors. We don't anticipate any problems with the apprentices since they already work under the supervision of licensed embalmers. We've been training funeral science students at Founded Community College in Gresham for decades, making them wait to begin performing it until they are licensed embalmers. We also perform quality assurance so we will spot problems quickly and respond to correct them. Eye banking is a very frugal business. You hear about medical industry having a lot of money. Eye banking is not part of that category. We're kind of the mom-and-pop category, finance-wise, of the transplants, and we need to maintain the volunteer enucleators. It's important to us. This bill will help us do that. We scrape by on tight budgets. We depend on Lions volunteers to transport eye tissue. We receive generous support from common carriers like Horizon Airlines and Delta Airlines, which ship eye tissue for free. We do, according to state and federal law, receive a fee to cover our costs of retrieval, evaluation, processing and storage, and the delivery of corneas. That fee is $1,600, and it is reasonable. With those fees, plus some support from the Lions and a few other minuscule resources, we meet our budget each year. However, there is no surplus. There is no pot of gold to turn to if our costs rise suddenly. This small clause can have a big impact. The Lions put their energy, time, and personal resources into the Lions Eye Bank. Every day, Lions in the state get telephone calls to pick up eye tissue. They do it on their own time and their own gasoline, and they do it so people get the chance to see again. In 1998, we distributed 533 corneas, which to the recipients are miracles. Please vote in support of this amendment so funeral homes can continue to help people see again. Seeking majority is an unnecessary restriction. The agencies in Oregon do not retrieve donated eyes, organs, or tissues if any one family member objects. This seldom comes up, but it does. Under that scenario, taking a survey of a class of next of kin is a moot point. The other items in this proposal either correct typographical errors or substitute words with a more accurate meaning. They improve the understandability of the legislation. In conclusion, I applaud you for considering an amendment to enact this legislation on an emergency basis instead of waiting for many months. We can get started making a difference right away. Chairman Fisher, committee members, thank you for your opportunity to bring this information to you today, and I stand ready to answer any questions.
Good morning. Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Mary Jane Hunt. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Donor Program. And if I may just summarize, so I'm not repeating, we too are in support of this bill. And basically, the Oregon Donor Program represents all of the procurement agencies in the state, which include the Lion's Eye Bank, the Oregon Eye Bank, the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, the Marrow Donor Program with the Red Cross, and the Whole Body Donation Program, as well as Community Tissue Services. Our collaboration works together to improve our state in regard to donation and transplantation. And I'm here representing those programs, but most importantly, representing those individuals in our area who are waiting for life-saving, life-enhancing transplants. Currently, there's over 60,000 Americans waiting for organ transplants and approximately 1,600 live here in the Pacific Northwest. There are thousands of more individuals here who could benefit from tissue, which includes not only corneas, but bone, skin, ligaments, heart valve, and skin. We're asking for your support of this bill. We feel that the enlargement of those individuals who can help enucleate eyes will certainly help the individuals here. Most recently, a change in the Medicare rulings requires that all hospitals call the donor referral line when a death occurs in their hospital. We feel that this has a tremendous impact on the potential of increasing donations. As Tom mentioned earlier, there are already 1.2 million Oregonians with a D code, yet not all of them are becoming donors at the time of their death. As Senator Fisher, as you had asked in regard to the legal document of the donor card, the Oregon Donor Program stresses in our messages, in our education, that not only should you close your license with a D and sign a donor card, but most importantly, tell your family of your wish. Because when that happens, your family will, most likely, in the majority of cases, carry out your wish. They'll put aside their feelings toward donation and see this as something that you wanted. In addition, the Oregon Donor Program has recently included with the donor card a family card, which allows you to give to your family as a reminder, after you've signed your donor card, here's my family card telling them of my wish. So that is helping improve that scenario.
Do you have to go through the same process of finding somebody if on that donor card there's a notation that was signed by the next of kin and by the family members? Do you have to then have it repeated and confirmed?
Senator Fisher, I'm not sure if I understand. Are you asking if the family members have to sign the family card?
He has his wife as a witness to his signature. Does that now then free you up so that you don't have to ask anybody's permission when he dies?
No. In practice, the procurement agency still will require your next of kin to sign a consent form. And in doing so, they also require a medical social history. And that allows them to be in touch with your family so that they can assure that any organ or tissue that is recovered will not pose a threat or a risk to that potential recipient. So that, again, is part of the practice of why that family member is involved. We have found in our education and promotional activities that family members, again, feel very strongly in carrying out wishes, and that the family card has helped. And in the majority, families do not object to an individual's right to make that decision. So I think that in practice, even though the law states you can legally gift your organs, the family's role in the process is very vital to make sure that all health precautions are taken and that the family grieving issues are also dealt with.
Do you take any precautions when the obvious family doesn't know everything that somebody does? Do you check for STDs, for HIV, all those things before?
Yes. Senator Fisher,
tuberculosis.
There are a series of testings that are required for both tissues and for organs. Again, the number one priority is to eliminate all risk and hazards to that potential recipient.
Yes. I don't see anywhere it says in the law that if one family member objects that it doesn't go forward. Where's that written?
Senator Chairman Fisher and Senator Shannon, it is not written in the law. It is the right of the procurement agency to refuse on occasion if it deems it necessary. And that's where that issue comes in. If there's an objection, especially a noisy objection, I can imagine the person running to Willamette Week in Portland saying they sold my loved one's eyes over my protest. None of us wants that kind of thing. We have enough backlash when there's a television show that makes up stories about arms being transplanted and keeping the character of murderers and all kinds of bizarre things like that. We don't want any additional publicity going on about taking tissue over the objections of a loved one.
So it's a judgment call at the time. There's no...
Correct.
Testimony was that somebody exists, basically. They don't do it. You know?
Well, that's what they say, but there's nothing in writing.
Well, the problem is with the threat of lawsuits. Yeah. And it's not worth it for them to be involved in lawsuits.
This is very honest. So I have a case of someone who's just lying there and can't respond, and somebody over here is raising cane. I'm probably going to yield over here a little bit.
Mr. Chairman,
I don't blame them.
This bill is one of those bills that makes the person who votes for it feel good, and it does a lot of good to society. The House, once the emergency clause attached to it, they gave me instructions to be sure and bring it over to the emergency clause here to be attached to it, because there is some bills that maybe will make the law effective, you know, January 1 instead of 90 days after the session ends, and so we would like the emergency clause attached to it. Thank you very much.
I personally don't have a problem with that, but I have one other question. We have another bill before us that we had a hearing on concerning fund set up to with state monies that would help to pay for donors' expenses. Now, my thinking was that how many of your donors' families are refusing to do this on the basis that they may have expenses that they're not prepared to take care of or something by the use of major organs and things like that for donation, that they were just routinely.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, if I could address that. Currently, there are no charges to a family for any donation, whether that's tissue or organs. So there should not be any charges to that family. Like any other situation, when a death occurs, the family or your estate is responsible for burial or cremation. But there are no charges associated with donations.
So if, and we were led to believe, that recalls from the bill, that they were charged for the operation to remove and for the transportation.
Senator Fisher, that is incorrect. There are no charges. There are charges affiliated with whole body donation, which is separate from donating organs and tissues for transplant. If you elected to donate an entire body, that would be for medical education purposes, and the requirement is the body must be embalmed and transported to the Oregon Health Sciences University. Those are charges that are incurred by the family or the estate, but any donation of any organ or tissue is not an expense to the family.
Was not that the gist of the testimony that there were expenses to the donors?
Senator Fisher, is that Senate Bill 481?
I would
plead
ignorance of my memory of about 150 bills, isn't it?
I just learned of that bill yesterday and have not had a chance to review that and was not aware of that bill. And has that been through the committee?
We had a hearing. And I didn't have any way of, I haven't had no personal experience with it. No knowledge of it, and we have presented us that there were some fairly heavy-duty expenses to the donor's family.
Chairman Fisher and members of the committee, once in a while is an accidental bill sent to a family by error, and every time that occurs, we jump on it immediately and inform the hospital and or funeral home involved that it is, in fact, against the federal, I believe it's the federal law, and I'm relatively certain the state law, that it is not allowed to charge for for those items, and we get those charges reversed by the agency that mistakenly incurred those. There is no additional expense to the family for funeral services. Cremation of the body, of course, doesn't add any cost. If they are doing internal organ donation, the funeral directors must go through a more involved process. But so far, I haven't seen any funeral homes charging additional money for that. It does create a slight delay in the funeral arrangements by usually about 24 hours to be an internal organ donor, but that's not necessarily a financial impact. For eye donation, which is the majority of the donors that occur in the state of Oregon, last year we had 1,300 eye donations occur in the state. There is no additional charge whatsoever to the family or any part of that process. In fact, my agency tries to help the funeral homes by doing some of the preparation of the eyes, of the eyelids, before we finish our procedure. Since in an effort to keep the cost down to the funeral homes, they already do the usual steps anyway in every death, so there's no additional expense involved.
Matter of fact, if a person could arrange to donate enough of his body, we might get a reduction on the cremation.
It's not going
to happen.
This isn't worth the issue, but in Oregon, do you have to be cremated if you're going to be, embalmed if you're going to be cremated? You know that?
I'm sorry, Chairman Fisher, I'm not aware of those rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee for hearing us. Sorry about our 10-minute stretching.
No, that's all right. There's many questions here, and it's been very helpful to us with the other bill, I think. And I would very much like to perhaps have you submit a letter to that, because there's no sense in passing a bill if it's not needed. And so we could at least correlate this outside on committee time rather than taking staff time rather than taking committee time to bring this bill back into further discussion. So.
And thank you very much for moving the House bill forward.
I will look for one more member, and we will hold a work session as soon as I can find them. So,
Just clear the room.
There we go. Close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate House Bill 2936A. And we're ready for an amendment.
There's two amendments to move?
One amendment.
Oh, one, okay. Dash one?
Yes.
Dash two?
I'm sorry, dash two.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2936.
It is dash A2.
Dash A2 amendment to House Bill
2936. Senator Castillo has moved that we accept amendment A2 to House Bill 2936A. And I would ask if there's any further discussion, any objections. Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the A and Gross House Bill 2936 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Okay, Senator Castillo moves House Bill 2936A as amended by the A2 amendment to the Senate floor with a DPAS recommendation. Is there further discussion, objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier? The bill? Senator Castillo will carry the bill, and that closes the work session on Senate House Bill 2936A. Now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 974.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 974 stands for the prescribing practices by nurse practitioners to include the Schedule II controlled substances. And we have individuals here. We have a panel that will present.
All right.
Okay. Brian DeLashmet, Susan King, and Julie Dee. Start with.
Actually, very quickly, Mr. Chair, I'll get started while somebody in the board
and pages, I see.
Yeah, we're gonna stay again. Actually, I don't know that I'm gonna set right the table the whole time while publishing this back. I just wanted to basically start the proceeding. For the record, Brian DeLashmet representing the Oregon Nurses Association. The Oregon Nurses Association is very interested in this bill. It's a very high priority bill for us. Let me give you a little historical background on this issue, and then I'll turn it over to the nurse practitioners and nurse midwives to give you their slant and the reason for the bill. Historically, I've been with the Oregon Nurses Association now for 20 years, and the original prescription writing bill was passed in 1979, my first session. One of about two or three what I would consider very political compromises that were made at that time was this particular issue. We were very early in kind of the process of nurse practitioners having independent prescription writing. Prior to that, there had been some prescription writing in this state and some other states, but we were kind of at the forefront of that in Oregon. Since then, at least as far as this particular issue and the accessibility to prescribing Schedule II drugs, many other states have moved past that. So it's kind of been a 20-year evolution in which we were kind of out front, and now most of the rest of the, or many of the other states, nurse practitioners, in fact, have the inclusion of Schedule IIs in their formulary. With that, I'll let some of the presenters, and I'll step back, and then I'll be available for questions and kind of summarization.
All right.
Chairman Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Julia Gee. I'm a family nurse practitioner. And I'm here to ask for your support for Senate Bill 974, which, as Brian said, would eliminate the statutory limitations on nurse practitioner prescription, specifically for Schedule II medications. This is a small group of medications, but it's a clinically important group. It includes primarily pain medications, which is what I'm going to talk about today. Also includes a few of the barbiturates and the stimulants. As Brian said, since 1979, since nurse practitioners first gained prescriptive authority in Oregon, nurse practitioners have been able to prescribe other controlled substances in the Schedule III and IV categories, and consequently have a 20-year track record of exercising both caution and sound clinical judgment in prescribing those controlled substances. Again, primarily, though not exclusively, pain medications. So Senate Bill 974 would not actually change the scope of practice for nurse practitioners. It would just give us additional tools to help our patients who have acute or chronic pain. My own practice for the past 4 years has been in acute care at both Providence and St. Vincent's Emergency Departments in Portland. And prior to that, I practiced for 7 years in a primary care clinic in Gresham, where I saw a whole range of patients in all age groups with both the acute and the chronic health problems. I want to focus today on my current practice in the emergency department. Both the emergency department literature and my own experience suggest that one of the main things that brings patients to the emergency department is pain. And I see them every day. I see numerous patients who come to the ER in pain, either because they've injured themselves or because they're having an acute exacerbation of a chronic painful condition like lumbar disc disease or rheumatoid arthritis or something of that nature. It's incumbent upon me in the emergency department to respond to that pain promptly and without delay. Just a couple of examples from last week. Child comes into the emergency department, has a painful fracture of the lower leg. Child is crying and screaming. That's a child that deserves immediate pain control. Unfortunately, the child has to wait until a physician can be found who can give the order for a strong pain medication. That physician is involved in a cardiac resuscitation, can't be interrupted. And so the child has to wait for pain medication. That's really unacceptable. Or again, an elderly woman who has osteoporosis comes into the emergency department. She has a compression fracture of her spine. She's stable, she can go home, but she needs to go home with a prescription for something that's strong enough to control her pain. at least until she can see her regular primary care provider. And in the emergency department, we're really giving people prescriptions for 2 or 3 days. It's really impossible to control that kind of pain without Schedule II medication. Not only do we have, nurse practitioners here in Oregon, have a 20-year history of safe and conscientious prescribing of other controlled medications, but we are well prepared in terms of our training and our education to handle these medications. Nurse practitioners in Oregon are prepared at the master's level with advanced courses in pharmacology, pathophysiology, and the management of acute and chronic health problems. The management specifically of pain as a response to disease and to injury is always addressed in the pediatric, adult, and geriatric clinical and didactic coursework, as well as in women's health care and psychiatry. In closing, I would just like the members of the committee to think about yourselves, your own families, put yourselves in the position of being either the parents of a child in the emergency department who has a painful fracture, or imagine that maybe it's your mother who has a painful compression fracture of the spine. And I think that you would, like me, if I were in the consumer's shoe, I would want that pain relieved promptly and competently and with some compassion. Nurse practitioners are qualified to do that, and we have as our history of safe prescribing demonstrates. In 1999, the standard of care in Oregon is to treat pain aggressively, and it's to treat it with genuine compassion for the patient. I hope that you would agree with me that it's time to update the nurse practitioner prescribing statute to make it consistent with that statute. Mr. Chairman, I have with me here a copy of a letter in support of Senate Bill 974 from Dr. Dave Craig, who's the Regional Medical Director for Emergency Services at Providence Health Systems, and I would just like it entered into the record. Thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee members.
We will be glad to enter the testimony into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. My name is Beth Jenley, and I'm a certified nurse midwife representing the Oregon chapter of the American College of Nurse Midwives, and I'm also speaking in support of SB 974. When women choose the care of a nurse midwife, which is well documented to be safe, satisfying, and cost-effective, they should have access to all of the skills, knowledge, and professional expertise which we have to offer. This legislation will help to guarantee that the Oregon consumer of health care will have access to the high-quality care offered by Oregon's certified nurse midwives. Oregon's statute regulates nurse midwives as a category of nurse practitioners, and the regulations expressly recognize and provide that the role of the nurse practitioner will continue to expand in response to societal demand and new knowledge gained through research, education, and experience. On the third page of my testimony here is a list of the counties in which nurse midwives delivered babies in Oregon in 1996, which is the most recent year for which there are published reports. We attended nearly 6,000 births, which represents 13% of all births in Oregon. In 10 counties, nurse midwives attended more than 18% of births, with a high of 55% in Jefferson County. I'm told this morning that in 1997, we moved that number up to nearly 17% of all births in Oregon were attended by nurse midwives. Nurse midwives also provide prenatal, gynecologic, and family planning services to a far greater number of Oregon citizens than reflected by the birth statistics alone. This increase in the utilization of nurse midwifery services reflects the health care benefits that are achieved when all qualified health care practitioners are employed to their fullest capacity. A recent study conducted by the National Center for Health Statistics and published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health in May of 1998, documented excellent birth outcomes for nurse midwife attended deliveries, including decreased infant death and low birth weight. This was a really interesting study because it used birth certificates for the entire country to look at outcomes for nurse midwives. And it is only the most recent in a long list of reports and studies which recognize that nurse midwives contribute to the reduction in infant and maternal mortality, premature birth, and low birth weight, while providing personal, competent, and cost-effective care. And it says here I've included references. I don't actually have them in hand, but I'll get them down to you today. All of the research in nurse midwifery care has included prescriptive practices as a component of that care. There's been no suggestion in any of that research that nurse midwife or any other specialty of nurse practitioner is at greater risk of negligence in prescribing than any other category of healthcare provider with prescriptive authority. In fact, the National Practitioner Data Bank reports no single claim was paid out against a nurse midwife in regards to medication orders or prescriptions between 1990 and 1997. In certain settings in Oregon, the women who choose this high-quality option for health services are denied access to some components of that care, which are within the scope of practice of the nurse midwife and well-acknowledged standards of practice in the healthcare community. Pain management includes a practice called therapeutic rest, which is a well-documented and accepted medical practice which assists the woman in false labor to achieve pain relief and rest so that she'll be ready when the work of real labor begins. Alternatives are sometimes offered, but sedatives or narcotics are often more effective, and nurse practitioners are currently prohibited from prescribing these since they are Schedule II medications. This is only one example in which limitation or delay in achieving adequate pain management may affect the consumer that the nurse midwife is taking care of. SB 974 amends the existing statute to allow nurse midwives and nurse practitioners to more fully meet the needs of our clients. And as already been stated, it's not a new skill for us. The state of Oregon has already acknowledged our ability to safely prescribe the vast majority of current pharmacologic agents listed in drug facts and comparisons, and the substances defined as Schedule II are not more biologically complicated than many other medications which the state acknowledges we have the ability and accountability to prescribe safely and appropriately. And also, as already been stated, it does not expand our scope of practice. It acknowledges our own accountability for providing this component of care to our clients independently of our physician colleagues. And that would reduce duplication of services with potential for increased cost or delay in provision of care. Failure to pass this legislation would suggest that the state perceives nurse practitioners to be at greater risk for inappropriately prescribing potentially addicting substances. I would suggest to you that all the evidence speaks to the contrary. Nurse midwives and all categories of nurse practitioners are in fact less likely to overprescribe or prescribe in a manner which is potentially harmful to our clients and to the community as a whole. Thank you for your time and attention, and of course I'm available for questions.
Yes, I would maybe disagree with you a bit about scope of practice. Anything that increases, I think, could possibly be part of scope of practice, even if it didn't result in you doing anything further in the delivery system or something. I still think, again, that this were in your scope of practice, you would be here asking for a change. So I think perhaps I would guess when I would guess I would look at it from the standpoint of the training. And providing the training is there. We've discussed this in several committee bills already. I'm firmly convinced that private scope of practice is about as subject to change and about as always going to be with us. We probably could add that to the list of death and taxes in the future. Because as education and technology changes, so do the needs of the people to be able to work within those areas of training. And that's where we get into all this business of us being asked to be the phone and wield the knife between professions. And obviously, it would be nice if we didn't have all these contentious feelings amongst the different divisions.
Not my scope of practice that we need the knife, I'm sure.
You didn't realize it. You went out on the campaign. Well, I didn't go on the campaign trail at first, but pointed it. When you threw your name into the ring, you threw it in for a whole lot of things. You thought it was, you didn't know being legislative. You know, prior to that, you had more experience than that for the rest of them.
But anyway,
Senator, I have something.
Yes, Senator.
I have a couple of things. One is that if you count it, as what he said, extended scope of practice, what kind of training do you have in pharmacology or whatever you call it? Do you take the classes alongside of the students that are going to be doctors? Or do you learn this from working with doctors? Or how do you, how do you feel that you're trained? And the reason I ask that is because the naturopaths came before us and they brought this top dog farmer, guy that teaches pharmacy, and he said he teaches it to the naturopaths and the doctors. Who taught you? Why do you think you're trained?
It's included in our curriculum as nurse practitioners and nurse midwives, and our curriculum includes a variety of physicians, pharmacologists, and nurse practitioners with experience who treat that.
In your classes, is it just nurses, or is it people that want to be doctors?
Mine were nurse midwives and nurse practitioners.
Okay. Do you want to
Senator Fisher and Senator Shannon, we actually have a professor of nursing scheduled to testify. So if you'd like to have her come forward now and answer that specific question, she
Well, yeah. And then I have
Would you introduce yourself? Susan King, Oregon Nurses Association. Thanks.
So I have a second question, whoever, and that one is that would you be monitored like the doctor so we could see this nurse practitioner that's oversubscribing drugs, or would you just be out there? I mean, because that's our concern, is that here we give them this permission and they're just writing prescriptions. Wouldn't you still be monitored like you have been?
Yes, Senator Fisher and Senator Shannon, there are a variety of ways that any healthcare provider's practice is monitored. First and foremost is in the practice setting where you are actually working or providing care, and you're dealing with patients in the context of dealing with other professionals as well. So as a registered nurse, my practice is constantly under scrutiny by physicians and other nurse colleagues. Then you have the Board of Nursing, which regulates nurse practitioners, registered nurses, LPNs, et cetera, and deals with any complaint that's brought before it from either a consumer or another professional. There is a mandatory reporting law within our Practice Act that requires that anybody who knows that a nurse professional is acting unsafely or violating the Practice Act is reported to the board.
Or over-prescribing.
And then the third check and balance certainly is in the pharmacy community, where they see prescriptions that they think are inappropriate, over-prescribing, inappropriate prescribing. They certainly have an obligation both to the provider, to confront the provider that they have concerns about, as well as deal with the licensing board, either the Board of Pharmacy or the Board of Nursing.
So if a doctor, can I ask one more? If a doctor is taken to task for over-prescribing, what would you call them, number two medicine? What do you call them?
Schedule two.
Schedule two. Mm-hmm. Then he's either been turned in by his colleague or a patient or a pharmacist. There isn't somebody that keeps track of how many Schedule two blood drugs are lined up to a certain doctor. That's what I'm wanting to know.
Well, it depends. If the doctor's patient utilizes one particular pharmacy, then that record keeping certainly is easier to track because that patient is coming here and receiving drugs from one pharmacy. The Controlled Substances, the Federal Controlled Substances Act, requires record keeping, so it is possible to track the prescribing of a particular provider.
So the federal government could see if a nurse practitioner got out of line? Just like any
yes, in addition to the state government, yes.
You just wouldn't be turned loose on the world.
Right. Not generally.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Senator. Can I comment for Senator Fisher?
I just said right here.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just having been a fellow dean in the university where the School of Nursing was there, and I know in the accreditation process, you wonder about the qualification of the professors. Now, it doesn't mean there's always the possibility of a bad professor. I mean, a poor teacher. But as far as qualifications, every professor would be checked. I mean, to ensure, are you teaching course A? What are your qualifications for course A? And if you don't, you lose your accreditation. So you have some assurance, strong assurance in that standpoint.
I think it's great assurance.
Mr. Chairman, Julie Dees, may I just make one comment in response to Senator Shannon's question? There is a DEA number that every prescriber who has the authority to prescribe controlled substances
must apply for from the federal government and then use on all of their prescriptions. So the federal government, as well as the state licensing boards, take this very seriously, and they control really does need control.
Okay, we'll go ahead and take another question. The nursing home I was associated with in Corvallis prior to 1980 sent Bell Parks to Denver to become a nurse practitioner. At that time, we did not have the requirements in the nursing home in the state to have a medical director. Mm-hmm. And it was extremely beneficial to us. We questioned at the time, it's too heavy expense for us to take on to do something like that, because, you know, for somebody to take off from their work and everything and go back to school as a housewife and mother and breadwinner, the major undertaking. And we did it, and we were never sorry. She was a tremendous benefit, came back to work for us, and of course it increased her salary too, which was a concern to us also besides the expense of the time it took to get through the education, but it was a tremendous good investment, and I think we were rewarded many times over, if not in the monetary process and the satisfaction of the advance. Technology she brought to us and advanced abilities that they were available to us on the nursing home to serve our clients. So, I've been kind of aware of this nurse practitioner movement for quite a few years. I guess pretty close to its inception. Go ahead.
I'm Dr. Cheryl Howe. I am a professor and director of the Nurse Midwifery Program at Oregon Health Sciences University. And in addition, I am the president of the ACNM Certification Council, which is the National Certifying Board for Nurse Midwives. And I thought perhaps this morning I might be able to address some of your issues with regard to the education of nurse midwives and nurse practitioners in preparation for Schedule II prescriptive privileges. I teach in the Nurse Midwifery Program, obviously, at OHSU, but I also teach other nurse practitioners as well, and I'm familiar with the education that they get, the family nurse practitioners, adult nurse practitioners, and so forth. I can assure you that our students do receive the training that they need to assume this privilege. They receive didactic training in pharmacodynamics, pharmacotherapeutics, and the use of these medications in the classroom setting. In addition to that, each one of our nurse practitioner and nurse midwifery programs provide over 500 hours of supervised clinical practice and medication use, and specifically the use of Schedule II substances is a component of that education. So they not only hear it in class, but they do hear it in the clinical area and actually do it under the supervision of their faculty and preceptors. Beyond that, as was noted, our programs have to be accredited. The accreditation criteria from the American College of Nurse Midwives and the core competencies for nurse midwifery practice stipulate that we must educate our students in these areas. And when we have an accreditation visit, that is assessed at each time. There are also guidelines from the National Association of Nurse Practitioner Faculties, which stipulates the pharmacologic content that nurse practitioners must receive. Beyond that, as the president of the certifying organization for nurse midwives, I interact with the certification organizations of also the other nurse practitioners, and I can assure you that this content is on the exam. So they are tested on it at the level of national board exams, the use of medications, and team leading medications. So to that extent, I can tell you with tremendous assurance that our graduates, both in Oregon and nationally, as the programs have to meet accreditation criteria so that nurse midwives and nurse practitioners moving into Oregon and taking licensure here would also have that background. Further, our state board, in order to obtain prescriptive privileges, stipulates that the person who applies for licensure in Oregon has to have had pharmacologic content
And our state board, unlike some others, actually reviews every transcript of every nurse practitioner and nurse midwife who comes to Oregon to practice to make sure that the appropriate content is there. So I think that there are multiple safeguards to assure that the people who are asking for this privilege are prepared to use it responsibly.
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
If you have to call a doctor in the middle of the night or in the restroom in the daytime that you're working under or whatever, he just says yes or no. What's the pay relationship? Would it happen to doctors if you had this privilege?
No. No. The practice relationships between nurse midwives and nurse practitioners vary from setting to setting.
And doctors.
But I don't know of any setting in which it would be a financial
tie
to getting pain medicine for your patient. It's mostly, in my mind, a professional issue. I mean, what happens in these kinds of situations is that you call your physician to see if you can give a medication, and they say yes, and then you give it, and they've never seen the patient. So, you know, they're assuming a liability for your decision-making. You're the one that knows the patient. You're the one who takes care of the patient, who knows the patient's needs. The physician is rarely involved, and yet they have to somehow sort of supervise this whole thing, which is not consistent with Oregon statute, which gives nurse practitioners and nurse midwives an independent scope of practice. We are the ones who are taking care of the patient. We are the ones that are making the clinical decisions, and therefore the accountability and responsibility for making those decisions should be ours.
I have one more question.
Yes.
I know this sounds really not the smartest, but, and I'm not being facetious, but in your training, do you do surgery?
I suppose that would depend upon how you define surgery. Nurse midwives certainly do episiotomy repair, which in some states is defined as surgery, and then we do suture. Nurse practitioners are taught to suture lacerations and so on. I don't.
You see nurse practitioners wanting surgery privileges because you're trained in a hospital with it?
No.
No? You don't see a leap here?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
I don't. Is that the problem with fatalism?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I don't want to do cesarean section for hysterectomy. And I don't think that the SMTs want to take out appendices. No, this is simply, you know, when a patient needs pain management and you're the person, the midwife or the nurse practitioner who's taking care of the patient, you're the one who knows that situation most intimately. And it is both a break in the care because you either have to transfer the patient to someone else to get the pain relief that they need, which isn't good for the patient. It destroys the continuity of care, undermines the relationship with the nurse practitioner in that setting. Plus, you're transferring the person to somebody who doesn't know them as well and doesn't know what their needs are. So it's a real detriment to patient care, not to mention that it's not consistent with our current statutes for nurse practitioner and nurse midwifery practice.
Would you describe the classification here of the one, two, and three categories? Because it's my at least understanding at this moment, and I may very well not be terribly informed, that the class two drugs have reached a notch where they're probably considered to be habit-forming.
That's true.
Come under a little federal different classification because of not only their, their ability to provide medically needed help, but also their ability to get on the market and provide things that we don't necessarily want to have happen because of public drug laws and things like that. Could you expand on that a little bit just for our...
It's a fair assessment, although not all narcotics are at the level of Schedule 2. For instance, currently, under our current prescribing privileges, we can prescribe Schedule 3 drugs, which include things like Tylenol number 3, which is Tylenol with codeine in it. So we already have a demonstrated track record in dealing with some narcotic medications.
Would that drug have a sale on the
Yeah, you can sell people very easily out there if you were unethical. Yeah. The drugs at the level of Schedule 2 are drugs like morphine, Demerol, fentanyl, Tecanol, which is a barbiturate, and a sedative kind of medication, and it might have a little higher street value. I honestly can't say. Not having traffic in drugs. However, I think that the point, there are two points to be made about that. One is that we already have a background in dealing with some narcotics, and it's very clear that we have used that responsibly. And secondly, there's absolutely no evidence to indicate that should we be given the higher level privilege of these other medications, that it's going to tip us over into the scale of more unethical behavior. We simply have not had that kind of track record. And in fact, I think these midwives and these practitioners are known for not over-prescribing anything. In point of fact, I have a DEA number right now, and I use it so rarely that I can't remember the number, and every time I write a prescription for a controlled substance, I have to go look up my DEA number so that I can put it on the prescription. I don't think that there's any evidence which would say that nurse practitioners or nurse midwives don't have the background and training, nor the ethical background to handle the additional responsibility of these additional pain medications. And certainly as a nurse midwife, I need to use them. Women in labor have a lot of pain.
Good morning. My name is Karen Mayer, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity today to be able to speak in support of Senate Bill 974. I'm a radiation oncology nurse practitioner. An expansion of prescribing privileges to include Schedule II medications is a crucial issue in my practice that is exclusively persons with cancer. The use of Schedule II medicines is as much a part of cancer treatment as chemotherapy or radiation therapy. Approximately 50% of patients who come to radiation therapy in the course of their cancer treatment do so for palliation for widespread cancer that can cause severe and disabling pain. I'm educated and trained to treat and care for cancer patients with all the resources available, and Schedule II medications are the best that we have. Patients must come daily for radiation therapy, and travel to and from the treatment center can really be an ordeal, especially when pain is severe. Radiation therapy will relieve the pain, but it's not immediate. It doesn't work today. Thus, a pain medication regimen that includes Schedule II medicines is absolutely necessary to decrease pain and promote comfort. Pain is never static. It's always changing in frequency and intensity. When I'm the only provider in my clinic, I must send patients to another clinic across town to refill their Schedule II pain medications. And I know for a fact, and I can document several occasions when this has happened, the patients will do without their pain medication, or they will cut the dose so that they don't have to travel across town to get that prescription because it's just too difficult or impossible to travel further. This is truly an unacceptable situation. Nurse practitioners have an excellent record in prescribing medications that include other controlled substances, and I think everyone has spoke very well to that issue. Nurse practitioners who will most utilize this expansion of prescribing privileges are those who serve populations such as persons with cancer, chronic illnesses such as AIDS, trauma, and emergency medicine. And again, my colleagues have spoken very eloquently on those issues. I really appreciate your attention to this issue, and I must say that my patients and their families will be well served with passage of this bill. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
you have Teresa King and Jim McMahon.
I would like to enter into the record a letter from one of my physician associates in my practice.
So, also at this time, and you were out, I believe, when that was presented, but there's a letter here from Dr. David H. Craig indicating his support of the bill and his experience with working with nurse practitioners education and emergency services.
Senator Chairman, I mean Senator Fisher, and members of the committee, my name is Teresa King. I am a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, and I am the director of the Stress Reduction Clinic in the Department of Neurosurgery at Oregon Health Sciences University Hospital. And I also work at the Fano Creek Clinic in Portland. And I would like to introduce reasons why I strongly support this bill and also talk about ways that it would affect my practice with my chronic pain patients. First of all, I'd like to state that the educational qualifications of nurse practitioners are definitely adequate for allowing me to prescribe Schedule II narcotics. Nurse practitioners in Oregon are master's degree-trained professionals. Their training is designed to allow them to diagnose and treat a full range of chronic and acute illnesses, including acute and chronic pain. The second reason is the growing need in numbers of chronic pain patients. As you know, there's a big push to give more effective pain services to Oregonians. And nurse practitioners currently prescribe Schedule III narcotics. I've been doing this for several years in my own practice. The skills necessary for assessment and treatment with these medications are the same skills necessary to prescribe Schedule II narcotics safely and effectively. The third point is that Schedule II narcotics, the ability to prescribe it would improve the care of chronic pain patients. Pain management is an area of growing interest as medicine grapples with pain management versus quality of life issues. Nurse practitioners are in a position to assist in the full range of pain management services. In many settings right now, pain management is seen as a multidisciplinary treatment modality, which means that physicians, nurse practitioners, physical therapists, and other professionals are all involved in the treatment of chronic pain. And fourthly, the availability of nurse practitioner services. Many primary care providers often refer pain patients to specialty pain clinics. These clinics are usually staffed by neurosurgeons and anesthesiologists. Clinic schedules are booked weeks in advance, particularly for the physicians. Patients often describe great difficulty scheduling an appointment for medication management. Nurse practitioners are more readily available to fill the role and improve patient care. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that Schedule II narcotics have to be signed, so the patient has to come and pick up that prescription in person. Those prescriptions cannot be called into a pharmacy, but Schedule III narcotics can be. So as an example of something that happened in the clinic, I was in the clinic at OHSU several weeks ago, and the doctor who I worked with there was called away for an emergency. And a patient who had run out of his narcotics on Sunday, that kind of waited for his Wednesday appointment, and he came in and he had been going through withdrawal for 2 days. And he thought that when he came into the clinic on Wednesday, he'd be able to get his script refilled. So he showed up for his appointment with me, and he was sweating profusely and having a lot of withdrawal symptoms, and the physician was not there to refill his prescription. It took 3 hours for me to have someone from the staff in neurosurgery actually go down to the operating room and get the patient's prescription refilled with a hand signed signature. And if I'd been able to prescribe Schedule II narcotics, I could have just done that there at the moment for him and saved that patient a lot of pain, which I find was unnecessary. Another thing I do in my role as a pain management person is I see the patient more regularly than the physician does, and I actually make recommendations to the doctor about how to either increase or modify their narcotic prescriptions. And I think it would be very efficacious to the patients to just allow me to really write the script as well as make the recommendations for them. I often make recommendations also to primary care doctors who send the patients to the pain clinic for pain management. And so I see the patient, I do the assessment, I come up with a plan of care for them, and then I have to call back to the primary care doctor and have the patient go back to their primary care physician to receive a narcotic prescription.
And I just think it would really improve patient care if nurse practitioners who are trained in prescribing could be able to do what we're making recommendations to do. And lastly, I would like to submit a letter from Dr. Jeremy Goodwin, who was a physician I worked with at Oregon Health Sciences University for several years. Dr. Goodwin is strongly supporting Senate Bill 974. And I'm available for questions. Thank you.
My name is James MacDonald. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I work with Multnomah County Health Department in Portland, Oregon. And for the last 9 years, my primary care practice has been predominantly devoted to people living with HIV and AIDS. In working with this population, obviously I manage people that have multiple chronic health problems, including complications from their background HIV disease. Most of my patients are on very complicated multi-drug regimens, very difficult polypharmacy. It's one of the major skills that we develop in the delivery of primary care services to people living with HIV because they require polypharmacy. Many of my patients have complications or manifestations of HIV disease that are painful. Many of my patients have adverse reactions or side effects to their drug therapy that are painful. Many patients experience unintended weight loss and severe anorexia. Other patients develop malignancies as well as non-malignant pain syndromes. And I still have, unfortunately, despite what the media would lead you to believe, people do still die of HIV disease very prematurely. And I have many patients who still die, and I am responsible for orchestrating their dignified death. In order to meet the needs of my patients, they require Schedule II drugs. I already manage patients using long-term or long-acting opioids such as MS-Contin, OxyContin, or methadone. I also manage patients using anti-anorectic agents such as Marinol. I occasionally co-manage with psychiatry patients that require psychostimulant use, either because of severe dementia or morbid depression, such as methylphenidate or dexedrine. In each and every case, I must route the prescription renewals and the patient chart to a physician colleague for co-signature. In working with the long-term care facilities, I have patients in hospice, nursing homes, long-term adult foster care. I have to obtain physician telephone orders for appropriate Schedule II drugs and subsequently ensure that a physician's signature ends up on those orders, as I cannot independently order them for these facilities and the providers in those facilities. These add additional steps, cost, and delay to patient care. Again, I do encourage your enthusiastic support to adding Schedule II prescriptive authority for nurse practitioners in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a letter from Thomas Johnson, MD, supporting this bill. And we also have Jeremy Goodman, MD, writing a strong support of this bill. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Oh, I did have one more question. Now, I believe in the age when we arranged for our RN to go and take some nurse practitioner training, there was nothing available in Oregon. How does that stand now? Where can I go to get this nurse practitioner and or nursing aid?
Actually, Senator Fisher and members of the committee, there are two in the state of Oregon that provide programs training and educating nurse practitioners, only one for nurse midwives, and that's the Oregon Health Sciences University. OHSU, in particular, in addition to having its main campus located in Portland, has an outreach program so that nurses from your area or other areas can actually be educated for the most part in the local area where they live and practice. The other program is University of Portland, a private institution in the state, in the city of Portland.
Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Yes, yes.
I've been in and out, but has anybody testified against this book?
Yes. Coming to that.
I missed it. Oh, coming up next. Okay. Right.
Thank you very much for coming and being patient during the process here.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. In reference to a question that was asked earlier, I believe, on stroke resolution, I think the answer to your question is that if you observe the weather of Oregon most of the year, it's enough to depress most anyone. Seems fairly obvious.
Yeah, just a second. That's Western Oregon, Eastern Oregon sunshine.
That is true. Thank you for the correction.
Correct.
We, unfortunately, because of scheduling, we actually had two physicians who were going to be present to testify on this legislation, but due to sites and medicine, they were not able to make it on such short notice. Which is unfortunate. I do have, and I believe you've just been handed a letter from Dr. Martin Skinner, who is a board-certified primary care internist and associate medical director for Mount Hood Hospice. And he addresses some of the issues that I think the committee needs to at least consider. Among those are his comments regarding the management of severe pain. Typically not well managed by nurse practitioners. And his point is found in the last paragraph on the first page, where he states diseases or injuries producing pain severe enough to warrant Schedule II narcotics, especially on an outpatient basis, deserve the most accurate diagnosis. This is something that very few, if any, nurse practitioners as nurses with 1 to 2 years of extra training can adequately do. Nurse practitioners are valuable contributors to the healthcare team, but chiefly with acute care, straightforward problems, and in preventative care. Nurse practitioners are not comparable to a doctor when the problems are serious, complex, or life-threatening. Nurse practitioners should not be managing heart attacks, pulmonary embolies, or major trauma or failed backs. And interestingly, in some of the testimony that you heard earlier, a couple of the examples given was treatment in the emergency department, where, in fact, you have medical teams, physicians, nurses, and others who are readily available to treat patients who have broken legs, gunshot wounds, and any other imaginable kind of injury or disease. You'll also notice that there is a whole host of different types of practitioners. You have psychiatric nurse practitioners, for example. This legislation obviously would permit nurse practitioners to prescribe psychotropics, antidepressants, that are very significant and very addictive as well. There is not any differentiation apparently made between nurse midwives who have different educational requirements, nor is there any kind of collaborative consideration in the legislation where you have someone with a severe disease or injury or illness where they may be going to more than one practitioner, and appropriately so. Another example was given for cancer patients where someone might have had difficulty in getting access to pain medication. I've participated in, or at least observed, cancer clinics where patients are being treated in the process. And I have at least never seen a patient in those circumstances where they are not asked on a regular basis and provided pain medication to deal with the pain that is involved in that process. It must be an exceedingly rare circumstance where that circumstance occurs, or at least in my experience. I think the other thing, Mr. Chairman, given the actions of the committee earlier last week, that the committee really seriously needs to begin to consider some type of legislative concept to develop a process for some kind of pre-thought of determining what kind of scope of practice issues the legislature is really prepared to consider and adopt and recommend. And by that I mean to create or establish a task force or a commission with highly trained medical personnel from different fields, medical and otherwise, that tries to establish some basis of evaluating whether or not these sorts of proposals are really legitimate and needed. I've not heard today, really, that there has been any statistical or evaluative information that is objective and quantifiable.
You haven't? Excuse me.
Other than anecdotal, personal determinations that it is something that they believe they're ready to do. There's a big difference between saying that outcomes of birth, typically nurse midwives who attend births are have patients who have uncomplicated births. At least that has always been the presentations in the past, that women who might have complicated births are typically referred to OB-GYNs for care. But no, I have not seen quantifiable objective
data. Mr. Chairman, may I?
Yes,
Senator,
we might come to a break there.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, Scott, in a sense, you guys don't make it easy because you can't get agreement within your own profession, although that's one of the problems, I think. I wonder, for example, if you mentioned the emergency part of it here, and here we have the regional director of Providence and St. Vincent Medical Centers, the regional director for emergency services. Andy, is he a member of the organization? Do you know Dr. Craig?
I don't know Dr. Craig, but he is likely a member.
He's likely a member of your organization. Now, here's the guy who directs the whole emergency service. You're telling us to do it. And you're telling us not to. I mean, I'm kind of in a... He has confidence in them. So if you're sitting up here, you know, you say, gosh, this guy, you must think it's okay.
Well,
what would you do? You were sitting here, Scott.
Quite often, that is one person's opinion.
Well, that's the letterhead, and my guess is liability and all those factors. He's the regional medical director, not just he's just not a little doctor over here. He's the regional. This is pretty big, isn't it? I think.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Duncan, I can't say whether he's speaking for Providence healthcare systems or not. But,
that's the question I had, you know. And then here's the cancer doctor who's saying the same thing. I work side by side with them, and they can do it. That's what I'm, my point is, guys.
Mr. Chairman, I have quite often seen letters from physicians on different issues that if they think through the implications of how legislation affects not only a collaborative arrangement or the process of how inpatient acute services are provided, they quite often reflect on those issues differently. Now, I have no idea how this legislation has been presented, nor do I suspect that some of the physicians who have written to the committee, which is their right, have thought through the breadth of this proposal.
I'm going to enter into the record that Dr. Craig's testimony is on Providence St. Vincent Medical Center stationery, with their addresses and with his name and title outlined on this, and very much my opinion that he is writing this as his, as from his position that he's holding at that point, at this point in time, with the Providence St. Vincent Medical Center. And I think that's his entire premise in here, that he has worked through their emergency room, the emergency department setting over a period of years, and indicates that he has complete confidence in their abilities from his on-the-job observations here. I see the letter couldn't be much more direct.
Senator Fisher?
Yes, Senator
Fisher. Have you entered into the record the Legacy Cancer Service, Dr. Thomas? He strongly supports it, and there's one from a Dr.
Thomas or Dr. Johnson?
Johnson, you're right. And then a doctor at OHSU, Jeremy Goodwin. But my question was to Scott, is if I heard it right, one of the ladies testified, and I say this in reaction to this this letter from Dr. Skinner, in his, maybe it's his third paragraph, to end his severe pain, which warrants Schedule II narcotics, is typically severe chronic terminal, not well managed by nurse practitioners. And over on the second page, he says something about, I've seen nurse practitioners mismanage chest pain, and I have seen them mismanage cancer pain. And yet a lady told us there was no violation from 90 to 97. It seems like there would be a record of some kind of abuse. And then when you said that they don't take the difficult births, well, that's to their wisdom. They send them on. They have the wisdom to know when to move the babies to an OBGYN. And that's, every one of those ladies spoke with such, not that you don't have it, but spoke with such integrity. I would trust my whole family because they knew when, I mean, you can size people up. And I just think that the testimony has been overwhelming. And I don't think they're asking to manage heart attacks and pulmonary emboli or failed back. I think they know when a person needs to move on. And that shows because they haven't had very many dead births at home because they know when it's bigger than them. And I think that if you guys are going to come and testify against this, you should bring us some hard facts of cases of people that have died because of the mismanagement of the midwife.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shannon, I'm not sure that the testimony presented to you about no problems, I assume you are referencing Schedule III medication.
Mm-hmm. If they did that pretty sloppy, I wouldn't give them Schedule II.
You know, I'm sure that the Board of Nursing, if you inquired, can probably provide you over the course of, I guess, the same period of time. And I'm not to say, and I'm not saying that physicians have not inappropriately prescribed either, but I think the Board of Nursing most certainly is able to provide you with any disciplinary action that have involved either nurse midwives, nurse practitioners, and or either schedule prescription problems, or addictive problems. But the committee is not, I don't believe, required in that arena, but it's certainly a legitimate question.
Maybe I misunderstood, but it seems to me they had a record of success in their disciplinary. What were they talking about? You want to clarify that? Or can you come and clarify it here?
Sure.
Yeah, I thought from 1997. What were we talking about?
Senator Fisher and Senator Shannon, I believe the reference was to lawsuits, but just for the record, I consulted with the staff of the Board of Nursing because my direct experience is now a few years old, and I'm looking at data for the last 4 years, and my source is Mary Ann Bell Thompson, who heads the disciplinary section of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. the board does get prescribing complaints just as the Board of Medical Examiners does. Typically those are from consumers. Often they are unhappy with the choice of drug, unhappy with the approach of the provider, but rarely after a full and complete investigation is done is a provider found to have violated the Practice Act in terms of unsafe prescribing or putting the patient at risk. There have been, during the last 4 years, very, very few investigations that have yielded any hard data that there has been a violation of prescribing standards. One is going on currently that the board is investigating, and that doesn't involve prescribing off the formulary. That case is not yet resolved. Another about 3 years ago. So for the past 4 years, there have been not more than three cases based on the data from the Board of Nursing, and I certainly can ask them to verify that for you if you wish.
Yeah, but how many nurses are we? Three out of?
Well, we have about 1,300 nurse practitioners in the state and about 30-some thousand registered nurses.
What I would like to ask in relationship to your question, Senator Shannon, is the fact that prescribing off the formulary is not what we're discussing here. That is something that is totally inapropos to the discussion here, because that's somebody that's going out of the rules and regulations to do something that is not a proper method of practice, and that has absolutely nothing to do with that any more than doctors should be infringed upon, because a doctor in Roseburg some time ago was basically alienated from practice in some of the hospitals for having a particular problem with his own prescribing and or a lack of prescribing, but using them himself. And so I don't think that, you know, this is not what we're really discussing. It isn't apropos, but what I would say is, do you have any cases specifically to this you can put your finger on? And the number of them that have actually been where they have been within the realm of their practice that have not acted on as to the professional ethics or as to the professional competence. That's what I would be interested in knowing. Do you have such cases?
Yes, Senator Fisher, my question to the board staff was as broad as possible to catch any violations of the formulary of prescribing. And so for the past 4 years, no. The ones that they cited to me were, as you say, not particularly relevant to this issue, but there have not been any investigations that have yielded violations of inappropriate prescribing within their current scope.
And if I may finish, glad to have my colleagues join me in their own desire. I guess I should have joined
the real martyr. I would think if I were in your position, I would come up there with at least two or three other people. if I had to twist somebody's arm and beat them over the head.
First of all, you are in fact talking about addictive narcotics that are used illicitly, and there are implications with that. But the other point I was going to make about this legislation, which I'm sure the chairman and the committee is aware of, this also has, obviously, insurance coverage issues and implications, which I presume the committee finds acceptable as well.
Everybody testifying, I'm sure the insurance companies find them quite acceptable, because I don't even find them sticking around to
hear these. Yes, Mr. Chairman. But I just wanted to mention that as well. Excuse me.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, Mr. Chairman, in relationship to Senator Shannon's question about the four-year span that was alluded to by a previous speaker, I think some confusion as to Board of Nursing and a Board of Nursing investigations and sanctions versus liability on liability coverage. And I think the previous speaker that spoke at some time in the future was talking about cases in which somebody sued and the insurance company that was covering them, the liability insurance carrier, in fact, had a case that they had to pay out on. So there was two different
avenues. I'm easily confused.
I just wanted to clarify that there is Board of Nursing action and investigation versus the litigation piece, and those were two different issues.
I've personally been involved in a suit where the insurance company was forced to pay that we were totally exonerated in our practice. And it stems back to some of our stupidity within our legal system. And it frustrates me that we can't get at some of these things here. In this particular is a situation where it was proven that basically, as far as the state and the SDSC or the forerunner of SDSC is concerned, our practices have not been at fault. There wasn't injury involved. And for somebody to have any remuneration for an injury, either we had to be at fault or they didn't get any recovery. Plain and simple. A split jury, 10 to 2. One more on our side would have invalidated the complaint. The whole thing. I walked out of there jawing up and down that never in my life would I have any confidence in our justice system. I haven't really seen a lot since that time to change my mind. It may be better than Russia's, it may be better than Cuba's, but it's got a lot of ways to go before. I had no problem whatsoever with the situation involved with someone being compensated because of what the incident happened. But when it was beyond our control, when it was beyond even what we were required to do by license or anything else, we actually took the cost beyond what was required. I left there with a very distasteful feeling in my mouth over the whole process, and that really hasn't changed, and that was nearly 30 years ago.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I am very supportive of this bill. I think the nurses have done a great job at talking about why there is a need for this, and I personally have a great deal of respect for those in the nursing profession and feel very confident that they would use this expanded responsibility very responsibly and cautiously, and I'd like to see us eventually move this bill.
I intend to bring it back.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Do we have anyone else that wish to testify that we didn't get time? Hearing none, I'm going to close the hearing on the Senate Health and Human Services Committee and the public hearing on Senate Bill 974.